Hi everyone, and welcome to Wild Trekking, Ecology, Technology and Micro Adventure in Cape York. And just to set the scene today, we are on anchor on board ICE. It's a 50-foot MacIntyre designed... I didn't look at the rig. I'm going to say ICE Going Ketch, is it, Don?
Sure is.
Oh, thank God for that. We have Don MacIntyre in the house on his own boat, so it's hardly in the house. And we also have Dior Sheen, Xanthi Smith. Obviously, Duncan's doing the speaking, and Monty is here. I'm not sure, are you talking, Monty, or not?
Hi.
Maybe, yeah.
Don, maybe a bit.
Maybe Monty might talk a little bit. Don, just to background a little of what we have done, we've been sailing for about 5 years. We left New Zealand about 5 years ago. We met the Sheens on board Wildlife in Whangarei Marina. It seems like a lifetime ago, but it was probably only 2012.
And no,
funnily
like
enough,
fever.
We've got a fairly long mono, and I pulled it. We trundled into Whangarei Marina, and I was thinking, how am I going to turn around here and fit into that spot? And Dave appeared on the out of the very nice white catamaran Wildlife and caught a rope and. Pulled us into position nicely. We hadn't been offshore, and I think we'd actually just done our first night passage from Auckland up to Whangarei as a bit of a training expedition for our planned offshore adventures, and I think I might have been a little tired, so I was very pleased to see Dave and Dior and the family climb out of Wildlife.
Our intro to the Sheens is completely different. My crew wanted to know where the surf spots were, and said, that guy over there knows, so they found out. That was about 4 years ago.
Right. I know something of Don as a sort of a well-known and very experienced Australian yachtsman. I know of your polar expedition, which I think was 94, 95?
Yeah, all of 95.
Yeah, so
that one, yeah.
This is before Xanthi and Dior were born, of course.
Yep.
And I know of your bounty expedition. I think I've seen that on television.
Yeah, that was 2010. It started right here at Tofua, about 30 miles away.
Right, okay. And I guess that interests us from the point of view that we're now living in Cape York, Cooktown in Cape York, and we've set up a vet clinic there. And it's always fascinated me, that expedition, because the men aboard were so terrified of Australia that they were prepared to completely bypass the continent. is that assumption correct?
Very much so.
Talking about the bounty expedition?
Yeah, very much so. They had a bad experience in the first time they left the ship out at Tofua. One of their men was killed by the Tongans, and they were chased away from the Fiji Islands, assuming that they would be eaten, and they probably would have been if they had have made contact. And so when they got to Australia, they went through Bligh Pass on the reef and headed to a little island called Restoration Island, which is only a few hundred metres off the coast of Australia. Mm. And they knew that Aboriginals were around, but they made efforts to make sure they didn't realise they were on that island. And they stayed there for 3 days, 2 nights, and basically then kept going and never touched Australia again until they got clear.
How long ago was it?
This was the voyage taken by Bligh, so these were
got me on the dates, yeah. I should know the dates, but what happened was William Bligh was the commander or the captain of the HMS Bounty, which went to Tahiti to get breadfruit, which you know about,
yes,
to take back to the Caribbean to feed the slaves, you might say, in the Caribbean. They didn't have breadfruit. And they did all that. They came through here on their way back to England. The crew were a bit rebellious. They landed here in Namooka to get water, okay? And then when they left here, they were sailing only 24 hours. And that night, there was a big blow-up with the captain and Fletcher Christian over some stolen coconuts. And the next morning at 6 a.m. in the morning on the 28th of April, they had the mutiny. And they were only about 20 miles from the island of Tofua, the active volcano. And they were set adrift in a little boat. It was only 25-foot long boat with Bligh and 18 of his men. So it was very low freeboard. And effectively, to shorten the story, for the next 48 days, they basically sailed from here all the way to Kupang in West Timor, about 3,800 nautical miles, and took them a long time. And they nearly all died, but he got them all there alive. It was quite an epic journey, considered to be one of the greatest open boat journeys in maritime history.
That's insane, surviving for 44 days.
48 days, yeah.
48 days.
It really was.
And also, yeah. It would have to be 3,500 nautical miles.
Yeah, just over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in a little open boat, bailing all the way.
Oh, gosh, no.
Yeah, so, and, you know, these guys didn't have a sat phone where, you know, there was going to be an Orion overhead. So if they didn't make it, they didn't make it.
More supply of noodles or something.
Well, yeah, exactly, yes.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. In fact, there's something, as you know, we recreated that journey, and when we left here, we only had, there was four of us in the boat. It was a smaller boat than Bly's, but we only had the same amount of supplies that he had. So we only had 2 weeks of water and food, and I lost 18 kilos during that voyage. We replicated many of the hardships that they went through. But the interesting thing, originally I did it to get close to Bly, and try and go through some of the emotions and some of the challenges that he had. I found during the course of the voyage I became closer to all the other people in the boat. I thought of them more often. I imagined them sailing just off, you know, 50 metres off our boat, day for day, you know, boat for boat going along. And just at the end, many things happened to him and his boat and all the crew. The same things happened to us. But right at the end, Bly nearly came unstuck, literally in the last day of the trip. There's a very tricky entrance, and they could have all very easily have been drowned in that last day. And exactly the same thing happened to us as we were approaching Kupang. And the difference was that we were then within touch of rescue with all our modern safety equipment. But if that had have happened to Bly, no one would have ever known about the mutiny, probably, and they wouldn't have known that they'd just survived 47 days of incredible hardship and lost it on the last day, which again was something you imagine what all their men were going through, thinking of the families and just about being home and everything they went through. So it was quite ironic that, or it would have been quite a disaster if they had all lost their lives on the last day.
Yeah, that would stink, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We've survived 48 days aboard this tiny boat, except we hit a stone on the way in.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
When they ended the trip, where were they exactly?
In Kupang. That was a settlement at the time. It was a major exchange point for all the square riggers and the sailing ships in that area. They came there, they knew the coordinates of that port, and so there was a lot of shipping there. And then from there, various things happened. Then shortly after, some of their men did die, and Bly managed to hop onto another ship and get a bit further around to Batavia, and then from Batavia they managed to get on another ship, and he actually got back to England many months later. But some of the guys didn't make it back. Some of the guys died on the journey then from saving to get back to London.
What time of year was this, Don?
The mutiny took place on April the 28th, okay? Yep. So it got in May, June. It was June the 15th, I think, it got in. And Bly, at one stage, I thought we were going to get in earlier than them, but he beat us in by 3 hours. In the end, we chased him all across the Pacific, but he beat us by 3 hours.
I mean, I think probably one thing from that story, and I believe it's, I think Peter Fitzsimons wrote a book called Bly, Master Mariner, didn't he? These guys were, you know, they had often not lived their whole life aboard ships, but, you know, gee, what they didn't know about sailing and open boat sailing and staying alive at sea wasn't worth knowing.
There's two comments to that. One, I've done numerous adventures during the past 45 years or so. This one, doing the recreation of the Bounty voyage, was like the best fun ever because it was so simple. It was just basically a little wooden boat with some sails and ropes and knives and hammers and nails and things like that. And you just went, you know, that was all there was to it. We had no charts. We really just went by the stars at night time, the Southern Cross, and sun coming up in the morning, going down at night. We just kept sailing, and it was just so simple. It was absolutely fantastic. But the other interesting thing was that Bly never told any lies, but he didn't want something, you know, in his journals that were written about it. He didn't emphasize the fact that he actually had more navigational information than what most people realized. In those days, there weren't charts of the area anyway, so he didn't have to have charts. And he had some nautical publications which detailed latitudes and longitudes of the key points of his passage. And he'd been planning that trip home for about 5 months before the mutiny, so he knew it all by heart. And he had these other manuals. So he also had an octant and a sextant, and he was able to basically carry out the same actions that he was planning to do with the Bounty to get home. It's called plain sailing, where you just sail to the west all the time. And with the octant and the sextant, even without an accurate timepiece, you could get a latitude, which is an east-west position line. So it was quite interesting to go through all those things the same as Bligh.
Absolutely. And just in terms of the food you had aboard?
Well, Bligh had sort of salted pork and bits and pieces. All we had for the entire trip was ship's biscuits, which we'd baked 9 months before, and lifeboat biscuits, because they were so hard to eat, we figured we'd be in real trouble. And instead of salted pork, we had tinned corned beef. So what it meant was our rations every day were two little lifeboat biscuits, how big is that? Oh, very small, and 85 grams of corned beef at 5 days out of seven. That's, we could only get the corned beef 5 days out of seven. So we had two biscuits in the morning, two biscuits in the evening, and we realised we couldn't survive on that, and we had to cheat a bit. And so for lunch, we had just a small handful of raisins and almonds. That was the only extra that we had off Bligh's rations. But even still, I lost 18 kilos and we nearly died during the trip with some navigational issues of bits, and I got kidney stones and all sorts of things. We all had some serious challenges to maintain that that sort of stamina on such little food and water.
So you had safety stuff?
We certainly did. We had all the modern safety gear. We had a life raft. We had individual life jackets with PLBs, like satellite beacons and so on. And we also had a satellite phone. But what we did do, so we could check in with our expedition headquarters once a day to tell them we were okay. But we didn't allow any information to come onto the boat, as in weather reports or the latest news or the cricket score or anything like that. You know, we tried to maintain total isolation from the outside world, and it seemed to work. You know, it was okay. But it was obviously, with any adventure, this is something that a lot of people don't realize. It's very important that you do everything you possibly can to minimize risk. So we had quite a detailed crisis management plan. I have a very simple philosophy that come the day I need to be rescued, I need to look my rescuer in the eye and say I did everything possible to ensure I didn't need rescuing, and if I did, then I'd done everything possible to make their job easier. So any adventurer, it's inherent to be prepared in that way. But nonetheless, there's real risks involved, and that's the attraction, you know.
Mm. Yeah. So when you did it, how many men did you have?
We had, there was me and three others, but our boat was a lot smaller. There's a funny irony here, because the second most, the second greatest open boat journey in the world is Shackleton's journey from Elephant Island to South Georgia in the Antarctic.
Ah, yes.
And I've got an interesting history with Antarctic expeditions, and I always wondered which would be the greater journey. So to build a true Bligh replica would have cost about $180,000, nearly $200,000 for a little timber boat. And I always thought, well, if I did the Bligh trip, I might want to look at doing the Shackleton trip. So I decided to build a boat which was a traditional whale boat, which would have been on the Bounty anyway. And it is actually the boat called the James Caird, which is a boat that Shackleton used on their trip. So the idea was, okay, just sticking with the Bligh thing, using this boat with four people and the gear we had, it's a lot smaller. It's half the size of Bligh's boat. Our freeboard was about not quite 30 centimetres. So when we loaded up, we had very low freeboard. And sailing-wise, it was a similar sort of challenge. So we were bailing all the way. We'd have water coming into the boat. We got knocked down four times. Like, we didn't invert, but we filled the boat with water and have to get everything out. And so it was a similar challenge, very small amount of space and crowded. But and as it turns out, having done the Bligh trip, I thought I don't need to do the Shackleton trip.
I've seen a replica of the James Caird, and I can tell you it's.
Well, I was certainly asked to do one, but fate took a hand after that, and I decided that it wouldn't happen, so it didn't.
What are some of your adventures you've had in the Antarctic?
Well, the first one it goes back to 1990. I was fortunate enough to be able to compete in a single-handed around-the-world yacht race. It was actually called the BOC Challenge, and it started in Newport, Rhode Island, in America. Then sailed down to Cape Town. From Cape Town, it went all the way around to Sydney. Sydney, it went down underneath New Zealand, around Cape Horn to a place called Punta del Este in Uruguay, and then from there back to Newport. Now, I was sailing a 50-foot yacht called Buttercup, and I came second in my class, which was really cool. And of course, when I did that, when you sail through the Southern Ocean, Antarctica is always on your right. And as I, when I was a kid, I read a lot of the Antarctic books and read all about the Antarctic explorers and certainly a New Zealand guy, Dr. David Lewis, a very famous yachting Antarctic explorer. I'd sort of known all about him. And also a chap that you guys have met, David Scott Cowper. David Scott Cowper, yes. He was a good friend of mine. I started helping David back in about 1983 on his first solo trip around the world to beat Chichester's record. And we often spoke about the Arctic and the Antarctic. So when I'd finished the BOC challenge, I still owned the boat, okay? And so I had some friends sail it back to Australia, and there's a strange set of circumstances popped up that led me to say to someone important, a guy called Dick Smith, that when he asked me what's next, I said, oh, I might go to Antarctica, and so I did. So that was using the same boat in 1993, I sailed to Antarctica with 200 teddy bears and 200 teddy bears. Yeah, I always have teddy bears on all my expeditions. You'll see a little bear over there. That's Ted. He's been with me for a long time, and teddy bears have been with me all my life. Okay, they're a sign of sort of home and friendship and love and warming and all sorts of things. Anyway. So in the BOC, I had 8 bears on board from friends. They all wanted to sail their bears around the world. When I announced that I was going to go to Antarctica, I was swamped with people wanting me to take their teddy bears. And Margie at the time, my wife, said, hey, this is getting a bit crazy. Why don't we charge them and donate the money to the Children's Hospital, Camperdown Children's Hospital? So that's what we did. So people paid us to take their bears on an Antarctic expedition. And we went south. Yeah, it was good fun. We went south to a place called Commonwealth Bay, which is directly underneath Tasmania, about 1,500 nautical miles. Very famous for Australians. It's the site of Mawson's Hut. And we were the first people into the hut for many years, and people didn't know whether it had been blown away. And we stayed there for 2 weeks and got absolutely annihilated by the weather. And in fact, in the 2 weeks, I only got ashore 3 times. We were hit by blizzards and all sorts of things. Anyway, came back from that. And when I got back, Margie had to stay behind on that trip because we had no money. I was basically just about broke after the BOC. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, having seen the place and thinking, wow, we could live there, I said, what do you reckon? Do you want to come back and live in Antarctica for the year? And Margie immediately said, yep, let's do it. So 2 years later, we built a hut. We put everything on the boat. There was 4 ton of equipment. We bought a bigger boat called Spirit of Sydney. And we sailed down there again, but this time we got left behind. And we built a hut, and we lived there for an entire year in this little box, which was 2.4 by 3.6 metres. And it was chained to the rocks because, as you probably know, Antarctica is not only cold, but it's very windy. Now, Commonwealth Bay is the windiest spot in Antarctica, which makes it, its reputation is such that it's the windiest, if not one of the windiest spots in the world, in the entire world. So we lived there for the year and had a great adventure.
Wasn't it utterly miserable the whole time in a small box?
No, far from it. Not all the time. I mean, sometimes it was pretty grim, okay? The longest we had was 20 days trapped inside the box. Right? Wow. You basically couldn't get out for anything other than grab the snow and ice to melt for water and so on. But it's fantastic. I mean, some people ask me, why did we do it? And I just simply say, so why wouldn't you? You know, it was an incredible experience, absolutely incredible. So that sort of led to a lot of other things. You know, we started doing a lot of different things in Antarctica. And basically now, since 1993, I've been in Antarctica every summer bar one or two. So I return now, and I'm in the fortunate situation where we get paid to go back. So for the last 12 years, 13 years or so, I've been leading expeditions and taking tourists down. Okay, so we go down in summer and we go into the Ross Sea or Commonwealth Bay and we get to share the experiences of all the animals and the scenery and the weather and the Southern Ocean and everything. It's quite cool when you can travel through the Southern Ocean and have hot showers as you're looking out the window instead of getting hammered by these gales and freezing winds and go out and reefing sails and, you know, getting tipped upside down or rolled over and all those sorts of things. Yeah. It's,
you know, you're really a yachty, I think, when you're flying on a plane and you sort of look down halfway across the Tasman and you sort of think it's much more comfortable here than,
We've all done it. The other thing is when you're down there getting hammered and you look up and you see a contrail from a jet and you're thinking they're eating their meals and watching their movies and so Antarctica, there's one thing that's a constant in my life, which is the ocean, and the other thing I suppose is also Antarctica. You know, they go together.
Yeah.
Yep.
One day, Xanthi.
one day.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's another world, and it's very hard to describe. And when you get there for the first time, you realise very quickly that it's bigger than all the pictures and all the videos and all the documentaries that you've ever seen. You cannot do it justice with anything. You have to go there to see it.
Yeah.
And it's a very special place. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Monty's got a question, Dom.
What is it, Monty?
Yeah.
Imagine if you went back and your heart was still there.
Well, in actual fact, there's another funny story here. We only planned to have the hut there for 1 year, but it was very successful. We ran a schools program and spoke to a lot of school kids during the year on a satellite phone. And so we decided to leave it there for 5 years, and we had other people in the hut. But eventually, 5 years later, I actually owned my own ship then. I had a ship with a helicopter and dive gear and all sorts of things. We did crazy adventures then, and we brought it out. So it's currently in Tasmania. But here's the connection. That hut called Gadget Hut is very good for strong winds. We had, you know, a couple of hundred knots. So it looks like we may be bringing Gadget Hut over here to Namuka Iki at the Royal Namuka Yacht Club, and that might become our cyclone shelter. So we're going from... Yep, yeah, you can come and spend the night.
Is there enough room for the
sheets? Yep, yep. Yeah. So we might end up with... I've got a few things to organise yet, but in a year or so, we may actually put it up over here. So from the Antarctic direct to paradise.
Yeah.
I mean, John, one thing you could comment on, you know, is that those huts, even the ones built by Mawson, Scott, they last extremely well because it's so cold. There's no bacteria worth speaking of.
Yeah, so that's right. What I'd say is this, though, that like Mawson's hut gets hammered because it is in the windiest spot in the world.
Yeah.
So the erosion from the grains of, not sand, but grains of ice is quite extreme. It's like sandblasting. And that's a big, just completely blows away the timber. So it's been in a fragile state, but the Mawson's Hut Conservation Foundation has done a lot of work over many, many years to conserve the hut and try and keep it in place for the next 100 or so years. So that's Mawson's hut. If you look at Scott and Shackleton's hut over in the Ross Sea, they experience nowhere near the amount of wind. Even still, there's been massive conservation efforts, but they're in much better condition.
No, New Zealand picked the best part of Antarctica, so
are the huts actually made of?
It's all timber. In fact, Mawson's hut is basically a Queenslander. It's an outback Queenslander. Mawson bought it as a kit home. Okay, it was just a typical kit home with verandas all the way around and lots of stuff. But then they build them in and they do double walls and they'd put sennet grass in there like seaweed and all that stuff for insulation. So it's Baltic pine, the timber. That's the timber it's made of. It's all clipped together and it's down on the bedrock and all pretty cool. You know, very strong.
Now, Don, we mentioned the Namuka Iki just before. Now you have to forgive me. Obviously, we come from a Maori background and Iki and Iti are very close together, so I occasionally say Namuka Iti and you must tell me off. Namuka Iki, which just means small Namuka, just tell us a little about your plans there. We've joked about we may have mentioned the Royal Namuka Yacht Club.
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny, fate lends a hand with everything, and I often say to people, when opportunity pops up, you got to grab it. You really have to grab it. And in life, that's very important. And an opportunity popped up here, and so we've grabbed it, and now we're still scratching our head thinking, wow, this is going to be a fun trip. So what's happening is there's a beautiful island to describe it for the listeners here. It's about a mile long, and its maximum breadth, it's about half a mile, and it's a pear-shaped or teardrop-shaped island. Beautiful place, sandy beaches all the way around, all sorts of interesting terrain and trees and palm trees and beautiful coral out the front. Yeah, everything. I mean, kingfishers. Yeah, it's great. So there's a big history here in two areas. The main island of Namuka is about a mile to the north, so we're anchored in the waterway in between the two. And this area was very famous in Tongan history as being the centre of Vaka sailing. Now, Vaka is a big sailing canoe, basically, about 36 metres long, and they would hold up to 100 people. So in 1807, to set the scene, there were 170 of these giant Kalias here with 5,000 men, warriors, and about 1,500 women, and they were all set to depart south, about 60 miles south to the island of Tongatapu, to conquer the last part of Tonga, and that's what they did. They won the battle, and so that changed the course of the entire history of Tonga and the lineage of the kings. Now, Namuka Iki is always controlled by the crown prince, so that's the heir to the crown apparent. And no one lives on the island, and we've been getting some support from the Crown Prince on our treasure hunting activities, which I'll talk about later on. And so we put a crazy idea to the Crown Prince about the idea of starting a yacht club here, and that he might like to be patron. And so it's the Royal Namuka Yacht Club on Namuka Iki. And part of the charter of that club is to build a series of varkas, which are small sailing canoes, about 6.5 metres long, and try and reintroduce or reinvigorate or bring back a lost art of varka sailing in Tonga, because basically there is virtually no one in Tonga now sailing canoes, whereas in the past, hundreds of years ago, Tonga was the premier sailing kingdom in the whole of the Pacific. And so that's what we're trying to do. And this year, next year rather, we start building the clubhouse. The yacht club will build two varkas. The Sheens are going to build one, so we'll have three. and then the next year, we're going to build another three. And within 4 years, we'll have at least 12 varkas sailing. We're going to hold a varka sailing festival starting in 2017, and that'll grow every year. And it'll run right through to a major international event in 2020. So that's the main focus, is to have this really neat yacht club. And just in the past few days, we've also decided that we're going to feature and build a bounty museum, because the bounty history here is really quite intense. And most people, even now when I talk to some of the yachties, they just don't realise it. And you tell them and say, hey, this is where the bounty took place. This is the last place that Bligh was on shore. They say, what? Really? What do you mean? And you point over to Tafua there, they don't realise the connection. And we've got a strong history with Bligh and the whole bounty story as well. So we're going to build a building alongside the yacht club, which will become known as the Bounty Museum. And also, of course, we're going to look at doing sandalwood plantations and clam farms, and we'll help the Sheens with their turtle projects, and there's all sorts of fun and games to be had here. It's a beautiful part of paradise, I reckon.
We have to talk briefly about treasure hunting, because Mum will never forgive you if you don't discuss it. Mum is a closet treasure hunter. And
what's the most like amazing or helpful thing you've ever found?
I'll tell you what we can talk about. Okay, the one of the most amazing things was just out the front of your place over on Namuka. There is a little wreck. I'm looking at it right now, just over there on the horizon, and we call that one the shallow wreck. We heard the story from the locals in Namuka, and they took us and showed us an area, and we eventually found it. And there's lots of stories around here about wrecks, but the bottom line was that when we investigated even further, we found the muzzle of a bronze cannon under some ballast rocks, and the ballast rocks are used on the bottom of the ships to keep them upright and so on. And all the wreck has now sort of disintegrated and fallen apart, but there was this bronze cannon. And so now, to protect that cannon, we've recovered it, and it's currently buried on Namuka Iki. And when we've got the yacht club built next year, we will dig it up and the cannon will be there. Now, it brings in, there's a very interesting thing that happened here as well. For about 10 or 12 years, I used to dream about the idea, wouldn't it be great to own a cannon? You know, and I'd even thought about buying a cannon one day, because it brings up images of pirates and battles and all that sort of stuff.
Just having a cannon.
Anyway, there was a team of 10 of us here, and we were all incredibly excited the day. I'll never forget it. We're all in the water bobbing around, and because I was called over, because a German chap, Huey, found the site, and he said, hey, come on over. And I didn't have any scuba gear. It was only 12 metres, but we went down, and as soon as I saw the muzzle there, I knew it was bronze, and it was just goosebump material, and everyone's on the surface swimming around. So, yay! So anyway, so we've got it there now. But the funny thing that happened was, having dreamt about a cannon all that time, it was like, wow, now we've got it, because we brought it back and said, what do you do with it? You know, you can't take it home and put it in the lounge, and you can't you don't sell it, because it's too, you know, it's very significant and all those sorts of things. And so it was really one of those weird moments where you'd finally achieved your dream, and then you sort of think, now what do we do with this cannon? But now we have the Royal Namuka Yacht Club, and
so
what better
have
to
it
have?
Sitting out the front,
yep, it's going to be on the deck. In fact, there's another story here as well, in that there's a very famous story here with treasure hunting and bits and pieces on a ship called the Port au Prince, which was William Mariner. A ship that was overrun by the Tongans, and most of the crew were killed, and eight of the crew were spared their lives, and they lived with the Tongans for many years. And so that ship has become part of folklore, and William Mariner, when he got out, he wrote a very good book. And so there's quite a few of the cannons from the ship that were recovered, and they've been passed down from one generation to the next. Some are in the British consulate in Tongatapu and Nuku'alofa. And anyway, to cut a long story short, there is another one up in the Hapai group in the Leaf in up just on the island of Ha'anau. And we've got an agreement from the governor of Ha'anau to actually give us on sort of loan one of the Port-au-Prince cannons. So the plan is to bring the, because that's a very significant find, we bring that cannon down, we'll put that in front of the flagpole, and we'll put the bronze cannon from the shallow wreck just over there on the deck of the yacht club pointing to the wreck. So lots, yeah, it was good fun. It was very exciting to find your own real live cannon, you know.
Yeah, there's one like that in Cooktown, an old one off one of, I think it was maybe Captain Cook's boat or one of the other old wrecks in the bay.
Yeah. There's a cannon in the museum from Captain Cook's.
But there's the one that fires as well. That's in the park.
That was sent to that was supposedly to protect us from invasion by the Russians.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The Russians are coming.
Yes. Yeah, they said the Russians are going to invade, so the government says have a cannonball three cannonballs and a cannon. The three cannonballs ended up in the well, along with two other skulls.
Okay.
And they shove lots of, I think it's, is it paper or what is it? They shove it into the
wadding.
When they fire the cannon now, they just stuff it with toilet paper.
Yes, and then pour it full of... Yeah.
And it looks quite impressive, to be frank, because it all ignites.
Yeah.
And,
boom, it's so cool.
Yes. Okay, well, I'll tell you just a little treasure hunting thing on the island of Numuka'iki. There is another wreck that is a really well-known story on the Western Reef here, and part of that story is that when the locals, they did recover some bells, which were part of the cargo, and some cannons, and apparently they're buried on the western tip of the island on land, so we'll have a look for those later on. Now, here's the best one. You're going to get some breaking news here. This is a world first, okay? Jane and Brownie, my rear commodore of the yacht club, and I, we discussed this at length, and we've decided we are going to bury some treasure on Numuka'iki, okay? And there will be some treasure. We think it'll be a cash prize. It'll be a very important bronze token. So whoever finds the bronze token, they bring it back to the yacht club, and we will be giving them a cash prize of around about $10,000. Okay, and the idea is that we will have a treasure map with lots of clues that you'll have to go around the island and pick up other clues. But before you, if you think you know where it is, and before you dig, you have to come to the yacht club, right? Pay $50, right? Be accompanied by a flag officer of the yacht club, and then you can dig. And it has to be within 1 meter of where you start digging, okay? And all the money we raise from the people giving us the $50 will go towards the Vaka Sailing Trust.
That's so cool. So.
Yeah, so there'll be a genuine treasure buried on the island, and people will be able to go hunting for it. And it'll cost them $50 to start digging, right? We might give children concessions. But, yeah, we've discussed that, and that'll be in operation probably from the first VARC, probably by the end of next year. We have to build the club first, and then we'll have it certified. There'll be another person that'll outside of our circles who'll know where it is, and we'll confirm that it's real. Okay, it'll be a bronze token, and if you find the bronze token, you could get, we're not sure how much yet, but it'll be a significant amount of money.
It'll be amazing, but you'll have people all over your island going dig, dig, dig.
Well, there's no point in digging, you see, because if you dig, you just get a bronze sculpture, which is only worth $50.
Yeah,
but if you've done it officially, so that you come and pay your money, you dig your hole, it's got to be within a meter of where you are, so you can only get to dig a hole a meter by a meter.
Yeah.
Right, so you're not going to dig up every day, then it's there. And if we think that you're more, there'll be another condition, so we don't have people digging up holes everywhere. But you know, we can say very significantly, if you're not actually on the spot, there's no use digging the hole, you know. But if you're within 50 meters or 100 meters, we might say dig the hole. So,
final topic, Don. I believe there's a Tongan entrant in the Golden Globe race.
That's right. We've got another little adventure that we're managing and organising, which is called the Golden Globe Yacht Race. So for all the sailors out there, most will know about A Voyage of Madmen and the first solo round the world yacht race in 1968, which was won by Sir Robert Knox Johnston on a little boat called Sue Haley. Yep. And a very controversial sailor there, Bernard Metessier in Joshua, that kept going twice around the world, basically. Lots of incredible stories. So it's the 50th anniversary on June the 14th, 2018. So we're running that race, and I've got a little boat. called Betty, a Tradewind 35, and I'll be entering that race. And so that'll certainly be an entrant from the Royal Namooka Yacht Club. And in fact, because I'm also the Commodore of the Royal Namooka Yacht Club, I would suggest to you that virtually all of the entrants will be honorary members of the Royal Namooka Yacht Club as well. So,
yeah,
so something to stand by for. Mm. Well, they'll all fly. In fact, the racing pennant may very well be the Burgee for the Royal Namooka Yacht Club, because we'll use it as an opportunity to promote Namooka and everything that's happening out in this part of the world.
Okay, well, that's a lovely point to finish on, I think. Best of luck, Don, and best wishes for the future.
Thanks a lot.
It's exciting, I think, for Namooka, and obviously the Sheens have made Namooka their home permanently, and we'll look forward to developments in the Bounty.
So we come back, eh?
What is Monty going to say?
Monty's going to finish the podcast for us.
I'm coming back in 2020.
Yeah. Oh, beauty. Well, you have a Barker. You want to get yourself
Monty's
a Barker.
Monty's going to sail in 2020.
Sounds like
How
fun to me.
How
old
will you be in
2020?
Wow.
I'll be 90. Yeah, I'll be 90.
There's lots of fun in this part of the world.
This is where I want to be.